May I have your attention, please?
Your attention, please?
May I have your attention, please?
May I have your attention, please?
Good afternoon and welcome to Attention, Please. I'm Phil Andrus. While Attention, Please usually looks to the immediate future, this week's edition looks back in time, a short step back in time. Scott Wilson, former publisher of the Port Townsend Leader, was a regular guest on Tossed Salad until he sold the Leader and was less bound to a regular schedule. Tossed Salad was the show I hosted on KPTZ until COVID and social distancing led to its cancellation. Late in 2019 and early in 2020, Scott and I developed a salad segment, which Scott titled A Short Step Back in Time, with the intention of presenting an oral, not-so-distant history of the transition of Port Townsend in the 1960s and 1970s from a fishing and logging town to its more culturally diverse present self. In total, we produced only 3 short steps before COVID intervened. This is the first, Scott's interview with Mark Welch. First off, a short step back in time.
You and I sort of, in a sense, co-created this, but the idea is that there are a lot of people in the community who are new. And one of the things that I think is greatest about Port Townsend, certainly the reason that I came, is because there is this cultural history that happened over the last 50 years, give or take, that shaped the community into what it is today in ways that are not visible. You know, they're not old buildings, they're not Victorian houses. It's kind of what happened when either people moved back or came here to begin with in the, you know, 60s, 70s, and 80s. And so I wanted to focus on that era, both as a way of reconnecting those of us who've been here for that period of time with what happened and what made it unique. And also, if folks are listening who are new to the community and don't know it, this is a good place to kind of get plugged into it, because one of my baseline concerns is that a lot of people are moving here who maybe are less connected to the community than those of us who moved here in years past. And there's some things that are truly unique about this place that shouldn't get lost.
Introduce your guest, Scott.
All right, I'd be happy to. So Mark Welch is my guest, and he's the perfect person to start this because of both past and current history. Mark, thank you very much for coming.
I'm glad to be here. This is, something I've thought a lot about in my past is looking at our cultural history over the last 50 years, which is, I think, eminently intriguing, and it'll be good for people to know some.
It certainly set the stage for an interesting place. Mark, tell us a little bit about what you're doing now, you know, who you are in the community these days, and then we'll jump back a few decades.
Well, I'm sort of getting my first glimpse of retirement now. I can't say that I particularly feel retirement, although I look at my schedule and say, there's nothing there, which is, you know, refreshing after, 40 years of having everything booked up pretty solidly. I retired as a teacher at Port Townsend High School just this fall. So now I'm sort of getting back to my roots. I'm doing some writing. I'm doing a lot of photography, exploring that, and generally just trying to enjoy this time of life.
What was your role at the school? What did you do there?
Well, I taught video production, photography, and web design for about 20 years there, so at the high school. Interestingly enough, I was in the same room that I went to kindergarten in, so I began and ended my educational career within inches of each other.
Did you find your gum under the desk?
No, but I did take a nap or two there. So.
Well, let's jump back then. So you have a very interesting and totally unique history here in Port Townsend because of things that were happening 150 years ago that related to your ancestors. Can you talk about that?
My great-grandfather, Charles Eisenbeiss, came here in the 1850s. In 1852, I think he was, or no, excuse me, 1854, I think he first arrived here, but he went down to Steilacoom. The story is that he landed on Union Wharf and found a $10 bill. It says, this is the place for me. And he came back, he ran a cracker factory, he ran a brewery, he had a nail factory, he had a brick factory, and was responsible for a lot of the development that went on in the 1800s. Basically, when the railroad didn't come, he died essentially a pauper, so there wasn't much left at that point. Old buildings, which I got involved with in the 70s. My family's been here for a long time.
So. And I didn't know he died a pauper. That's
well, I think relatively speaking. Before he died, he had built a crypt out at Laurel Grove. Probably 7-8 years ago, one of the roof sections fell in. So I had the opportunity to go out and take a look down and have a visit with him. And his first wife was there, and a child who had been seemed to have a record of that was obviously died as a baby. And they were in very fancy coffins.
I'll be
darned. He was in just a plain wooden box.
I saw the crypt last year. I think I was walking around. It's still, I think, the most notable crypt in the cemetery.
Well, he would want it that
way. Yeah, right, sure. But for people who don't know, Mark, some of the buildings that he built in town?
Well, the Mount Baker block is the most prominent one. They had a grocery store where the Silverwater is now, and he was involved in a number of other buildings and a lot of real estate projects, you know, where Port Angeles was sort of designed to be a utopian community. I think they sort of pitched Port Townsend as an economic utopia. Mm-hmm. They were certainly looking at it as the San Francisco of the North, and that was the plan at that time.
Mm-hmm. And he built Manresa?
Yes. Yeah. Not all of it that's there. He built the old section, which would be the north section of it. The Jesuits added the other section down below.
I see. Okay. And he was one of the big five at the time.
One of the big five, yeah.
The capitalists, all of whom I think were pretty much not wiped out, but certainly blasted by the recession.
Certainly diminished significantly. He had just finished up the Northwest Senate. It was going to be the Hotel Eisenbeiss up on the overlooking the mill, and they built it in 90 days. It was a four-story hotel, and it was never completed. Just like the Mount Baker block, the top two stories of the Mount Baker block weren't finished until sort of the economic renaissance came back, and Sam Kyle, under his ownership, has managed to develop that. But for the most part, they just dropped their tools and walked away.
Take us forward from your great-grandfather through your other ancestors to you.
There was the Welch side had a long period of time here. George Welch, who was he was on city council, and he was one of the founders of the golf course here. And
when did he arrive?
Well, he arrived in the early 1900s. He came here originally as a telegrapher. His family had homesteaded out at Beaver Lake out in the West End. And he and his brother Van, who later became police chief in Port Angeles, managed the place while their father ran a grocery store in Port Angeles. Their homestead was on the trail between Port Angeles and Forks. It wasn't a road, and so people would come out and they would rent a room to loggers on their way out. And he was also a photographer, had done a lot of work over the years with the Mountaineers and Achill Curtis and some of those people in the Olympic Mountains in the later time. But he became a banker in town eventually. Was the vice president of the Merchants Bank, and then started his own investment and insurance firm that my father came in and worked on.
So George married an Eisenbeiss.
She married Lillian Eisenbeiss, yeah.
Okay. And then your father's name is?
Joseph.
Joseph, Joe. And he grew up here.
He grew up here too, yeah.
As a photographer and?
No, Joe was a civil engineer and an insurance agent. He worked for the county for a long time doing road work. And then after World War II, he joined the family business. He'd gone back to American University in Washington, D.C. And then after that, during the Depression, they couldn't really afford to keep him in college. So he came back and began working in the family business.
Yeah, I'll be darned. And so what did that business, what became of that business?
Well, that business was an insurance company that actually he sold in the 70s to Homer Smith.
Oh, okay.
So it became the Homer Smith's agency.
And Homer, the junior, not Homer the third, but Homer, his dad, got started in Quilcene.
Yep.
And then expanded into Big Port Townsend.
Into Big Port Townsend, yeah.
And bought your dad's
and
insurance.
And bought my father's,
I'll be darned. Oh, okay. You mentioned the Mount Baker Block building. I think it's the preeminent building in town and was, it was always kind of the anchor of the community mm-hmm. in terms of the downtown architecture. Was that the location of the insurance of your dad's
insurance?
Yeah,
it was actually
agency?
Down right underneath the stairwell. It didn't have a large office space. They kept it small and it was pretty much a one-person operation. My grandfather was actually tucked in physically under the stairs in a room that slanted down to nothing, and he did his investment stuff so it was a very small office down there.
Didn't your family own the whole building?
Well, my great aunt owned the building.
Oh, okay.
Hilda Eisenbeiss, who lived in, also lived in town.
So at some point, control of that building came to you and your sister, right?
In 1975. When my aunt Hilda passed on, we took it over.
So what was it like in 1975?
Like I say, it was interesting because you would go upstairs beyond the second floor was finished, and the third floor was duds and subflooring. And then you climbed a ladder up to the fourth floor, and it was empty. And there was literally the tools had been left, and the workers had walked off the job when it was clear that it couldn't be finished economically. It was a sort of an albatross. And to put it this way, it never made a profit while we owned it. But we had a lot of fun with it.
Yeah, well, so you literally found tools. You found...
Yeah, toolboxes, tools, old doors. I incorporated one of the doors that had Charles Eisenbeiss's name on it, and being shipped from Tacoma, I incorporated it in my garage at home.
So you walk in there, you've got this huge building with a few rentable spaces down below, I take it, and no rentable spaces up above.
We had the second floor was occupied. Bill Daly, who was then the prosecuting attorney, was in there. He paid $25 a month for his office space. Bill Monroe was a dentist who was upstairs. The credit union was upstairs. But you couldn't get enough rent out of those spaces to really make any money. And when Bill died, he left owing me $250, an entire year's rent. He paid it once a year. Uh-huh. And I suppose I could have gone after the estate, but it was really much better story to just leave that out there hanging.
Yeah. More valuable as a story.
Yes.
About yourself now, I want to back up on your life a little bit. So you grew up here in town.
Yes.
You knew that building was part of the family.
Mm-hmm.
You went to high school here.
Yep.
And then you went off for a while and came back?
We went to college in Eastern Washington. I spent about 7 years over there. And then while Connie, my wife emeritus, finished up, we came back here and ended up living here almost accidentally. We had never really intended to live here. We moved into the top of the Z-Tai building, which is where Durr's Jewelry is now. Oh. And we were living up there at the time. Had thought about, at the time, because my mother had been born in Canada, I could have gotten Canadian citizenship. We thought about moving up there. We traveled across Canada. The only place that I found that I liked as well as here was Nova Scotia, and there was no employment. The winters were brutal, and they served bologna in the restaurants. So,
what's not to love about bologna?
What's not to love about fried bologna? So we ended up back here, and the town had been... You know, to go to your theme of cultural nature, the town had really been sort of, I kind of equate it to having been like a beaver pond. It was fairly stagnant. When you grew up here, you were sort of assigned a role at birth and expected to fill that role. There wasn't a lot of movement either way. It was very much a mill town and a fishing town at the time. And after we moved back, there was an influx, a sort of a renaissance that happened of people who came in from Chicago, who came in from a lot of different places.
Younger people.
Younger people that had migrated out here. I think of Ron and Jill Rohde, who came out, been writing cookbooks and restaurant reviews in Chicago and moved out. And they brought a whole coterie of friends and connections. Kenny Klein, who was probably the world's greatest bartender, came out with that. Lonnie Ritter, who really improved the culinary scene in Port Townsend dramatically. It was the first really excellent restaurant.
Now, this is early 70s,
Mark? This is early to mid 70s. Mm-hmm. And suddenly this became a far more interesting place to live than, physically, it's always been wonderful. And there's always been great opportunities. But from a cultural perspective, it changed dramatically.
And people, I mean, to some extent, these are tending to be progressive, lefty people, or just a wide variety of...
Primarily, it was you know, old hippies.
Maybe not so old at the time.
Not so old at the time.
They've aged in place.
Yeah, in situ. At that time, the economics were drastically different here.
Meaning tough.
Well, no, actually, in some respects, they were easier. But you knew you could probably find work. I mean, you could go to work at the mill. They were, you know, there was the mill employment was they had the bag plant then and a lot of other things that it was, we're doing finished products out there. You could do that. There was fishing. You could still get work in the woods. And
so resource industries
were still doing pretty well. So if you were relatively industrious and ambitious in terms of being willing to wear a lot of different hats, then you could get by. It typically seemed like if someone could last here 2 years, then they could find their niche.
So kind of a two-year window. I mean, people would wash out in the first year. Yes. And if they stuck around for 2 years, then they had a reasonable shot.
They had a reasonable shot of making it. And there were a lot of people who came, interesting people that had come here and tried to establish a life here and didn't make that two-year window. And they'd move off just because of the economics of it.
I grew up in a small town, not this one, but one in Eastern Washington. And what was it like for you being a true local, a native, and seeing people your age showing up? Was that sort of liberating for you, or were you kind of hunkered down a bit also in terms of the influx of people coming in? What was that like for you?
I really enjoyed it. I mean, it was what made it palatable for me to stay here, I think, more than anything, was suddenly, instead of this beaver dam I'd been growing up in, this sort of what felt like, as a youth, a very stagnant place, culturally. Anyway, suddenly there was this wonderful influx of people passing through, and many of them staying and becoming friends, and a lot of interesting things were going on at that time.
You know? Did they face resistance, though?
Oh, absolutely.
Not from you,
yeah.
But from other
parts.
Yeah,
I think I sort of look at my life in this town in sort of three waves. The first wave was the guys I think of now as old-timers, the Bill Daleys, the Walter Hurstroms, the guys that were running the show back in the 50s and 60s. And then in the 70s, that transition period came where we became far more liberal. We became far more progressive in virtually every realm, especially the cultural realms. Now, today, we sort of slid into this gentrification, which isn't all bad. I mean, but there are some things that I think we all wax nostalgic for.
Yeah, there are some impacts as well. You said, Mark, that if someone showed up in the early, mid-70s, they could probably find work. But on the other hand, there were, in those days, a lot of untended sort of empty buildings also.
Yes.
One of them, back to your large empty building, the Eisenbeiss the Mount Baker Block building. I want to talk to you a little bit more about how that building evolved in those years. Who came up and used those upstairs spaces?
Oh.
I know of a couple who did, but I want to hear it from you.
Well, you know, we were never great landlords. We pretty much gave away everything on the second floor. And we had, well, Drew Elliker, who, a wonderful artist. Drew had an apartment up there that he remodeled in lieu of rent. He remodeled it and used that as his studio. Marty Stadshog was up there. She had a studio. Bobby McGuire was my sort of resident manager. Bobby had moved up and taken over large portions of the building,
yeah.
Including the fourth floor at one point.
With his pigeons,
with
right?
With his pigeons. And for those people that don't remember Bobby, he was a wonderful character, a terrific artist. We had had an incident where a pigeon had flown through a window, literally flown through. It was a pigeon-sized hole in one of the windows, and a lot of other pigeons had followed the critter in there. So we had to clear them away, and creating quite a mess up there. So Bobby said, well, here's what we're going to do. He liked old traditional weapons. So he built a blowgun out of a piece of conduit. And then the darts were nails. But instead, we didn't want to kill the pigeons. We just wanted to catch them. And so he said, we'll turn the nail around. We'll use a large nail. I'll have a blunt head. And so we went up, and Bobby took aim and hit a pigeon and dropped it just like that. Just fell straight to the floor. And we both felt terrible about this. And so the end result was that Bobby started to get a huge affection for pigeons. He built a large pigeon loft up there and brought in a bunch of Birmingham rollers. So for several years downtown, we had this incredible flock of tumblers, which you would see that they were a combination of high flyers and tumblers. So they would have maybe 40 pigeons that would fly up 300-400 feet, and then they just fall out of the sky for 30 feet and then catch themselves and take off. It was a genetically bred behavior of the pigeons. Now, the really good ones, unfortunately, would fall on people's chimneys and not be able to get out. There was a fairly eccentric community in there. Rod Freeman had Grizzly Press, which was an alternative press down in the Mount Baker Block. So it was a lot of fun.
What did Drew do with his space?
Sure, well, Drew lived there. He lived there, and then he also painted there and did his artwork there.
Yeah.
There were a lot of projects that started and never quite came to fruition.
But all of them were fascinating.
All of them were fascinating, yeah.
So in terms of what we now see at that building, did that all happen when you sold it to Sam, Kyle?
All of the third and fourth floor development happened after we left the building.
Which was, when did you sell it?
In the early 80s.
Okay. Mark, you and Peter Simpson were key in getting and writing the one book that I refer to as the Bible for covering kind of this same period, the last 50 years, give or take. City of Dreams. So tell me first a little bit about how that came together, and then we'll close out by talking about...
That was Peter's dream. He, of course, he'd written a lot of little smaller historical works, and he decided that he would put together a team to sort of make a compendium, I guess, for lack of a better word, of that sort of highlighted some of the eccentricities, some of the character, and not a strict history. So Jim Heinen, myself, Nora Porter, Robin Biffle, he brought together Bob Biffle, Robin's father, for illustrations, and we all got together and started writing this book. And it was fairly ad hoc, but Peter was a good editor, and he kept us on task to the degree that we were able to actually get it out the door eventually. Mm-hmm. Thatcher Bailey was the, Bay Press was the publisher at the time. And fortunately, you know, Thatcher's dad had owned the Argus in Seattle, and he would say that his dad was never happier than when he was losing money. So Thatcher sort of adopted that in terms of the philosophy of this book.
Yeah, oh, wonderful. But if people haven't read it, they certainly should. And I know, Mark, then that you're cranking up to maybe do an updated version.
There's a gradually growing updated version online now, and you can access that through the Historical Society website. And eventually we may get back to publishing a second edition of it. So,
like I say, if people haven't seen it, they should, but it sort of works in alphabetical order. It's not chronological. It just takes a subject and addresses it. It really is mostly cultural history. It's, mm-hmm. it's the one published thing that kind of fills that gap together. So I think we're close to done-ish here. Let me close out then, Mark, with just this question. If you could tell newcomers, people who are new to the community today, you know, what it is, what it's been, what's that thread that has made this a unique and special place? What do you think you'd say?
Well, you know, I don't think it's one of those things that you probably had to have lived, but I would say that, you know, for them to get involved in exploring it a little bit and just to look around and talk to some of the people who've been around here for a while. There are a lot of wonderful stories and wonderful characters and that have been here and come and gone. And I think it's important for people to try and touch that in some way.
Yeah, wonderful. Perfect. All right. Thank you, Mark Welch. And back to you, Phil.
Just a couple of comments. The Historical Society, first with Bill Tennant, maybe before that, I don't know, now with Shelley Levins, are giving good attention to the very history that you two have been talking about. So one should watch their website or visit and see what they're up to. The show, as Mark said, that's in there now, Drew Elicker's show. And I didn't know the part about Drew and the studio downtown that you mentioned, but I know he'd been here a long while. And Scott, for you a question, when did you come?
I first came in 77 for just a period of months, and then I came back in 89.
Okay, so you are among the people that you're talking about.
Kind of.
I think you are.
I'm on the tail end of it, but I've always been interested in those folks.
I think you're in the thick of it, Scott Wilson. A short step back in time is a success, and well done.
Thank you very much. Glad to do it. Really glad to have Mark on.
And that concludes Scott Wilson's first edition of A Short Step Back in Time, his interview of Mark Welch. After editing, there was time remaining for music to complete the show, which led to my contacting Barney McClure, the jazz pianist who was Port Townsend's mayor from 1979 to 1983, after which he served in the Washington State Legislature. He now lives in Northern California. Barney sent me his album Not a Day Goes By, from which I've chosen his composition Fly Away.
Barney McClure and his composition Fly Away, a musical short step back in time. Unlike most editions of Attention Please, which look to the future, this show has looked to the past. Thanks to Scott Wilson and Mark Welch for taking us on the journey. Attention Please airs each Monday at noon and at 5 on Saturdays at noon and is added to the KPTZ podcast page found at kptz.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Phil Andrus.